This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
I'm not totally convinced that the Buddha really made all of these lists, but Buddhism has all of these numbered lists. The three refuges, the three characteristics, the three poisons, right? So there's all of these, when you look at the teachings of Buddhism, it's the four noble truths, the eightfold path, the five hindrances. It's all of these lists. And at first when you start listening to reading and studying, it's like, wow, there's a lot of lists. I have to memorize, like, this is like math. I have to memorize all these lists. I think there's really only 27 important things. It's not that much. Like, you can memorize 27 things, right? But threes, and I think you find three, like the Trinity, the Holy Trinity, like you find three in a lot of different spiritual and religious traditions, and it's really central in Buddhism, the three jewels, the three refuges, which are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And so when we're ringing the bell, we're ringing the bell in remembrance of taking refuge in Buddha, which means not the statue, not the historical guy, in my interpretation. Buddha, which literally is a word that means awake. And we're ringing the bell, and we're practicing, and we're saying, my intention is to be awake, to be Buddha, which is awake, not the Buddha, not the dude, but your own dudeness, to your own awakeness. Right? I take refuge in the potential of my own awakening. And the Dharma, which means the truth, literally it means the truth. I take refuge in the potential to know the truth for myself, directly experience liberating wisdom, directly experience the truth of that I can be compassionate towards my pain and the pain of others. The Dharma also has a meaning of what the Buddha taught, the truth that he came to himself, Siddhartha, and woke up to, and then teaches us, like all of these lists are the Dharma. The Four Noble Truths is the Dharma. The Eightfold Path is the Dharma. The three jewels, the three characteristics. But when you're looking at the teachings, I feel like that's their wisdom information, and maybe they're like a map. They're saying, if you do this, you'll experience this. If you walk this path, here's a map. If you walk this path, you will experience this. But it's still just a map, and that the true Dharma is when you experience it, when you have walked the path, and when we're really taking refuge. We're not taking refuge in the lists or the map or the terrain. We're taking refuge in the potential of directly experiencing it ourselves. And taking refuge, we started tonight with the community, association with the wise, the right kind of associations of friendships, connections, the kind of connections that support us, that encourage us, that remind us of our intentions. And we take refuge in each other. It's one of those things. There was a book, I think Stephen Batchelor wrote a book called Alone with Others. And meditation, spiritual practice is so interesting in that way, right? Because we're all on our own. You have to do your own practice. You have to develop your own wisdom, your own compassion. You're alone. Nobody can do it for you. But there's something about being with others that support us in doing our work, that encourage us, that inspire us, that remind us of our intentions and of what we're trying to do. I see all of the path as relational. Sometimes it's how we're relating to our own experience, our own pain, What's my relationship to my stress and my fear, to my difficult emotions? What's my relationship to my own internal experience of pleasure or craving for pleasure? But then a lot of it is, what's my relationship to you and to your pain and to your personality and to your communication? And so all of it, when we're taking refuge in Sangha, yes, it's us practicing together, but it's also just taking refuge in relational practice. And sometimes it's with other meditators, and most of the time it's not with other meditators, right? Most of the time you're out in the world, not driving the freeway with a whole bunch of meditators. Or they don't seem like they meditate, or you don't seem like you meditate when you're driving the freeway. But that is part of our relationship. What's our relationship to that activity of being in traffic or being in society? So the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. I also wanted to reflect a little bit on how Sangha and the relational aspect isn't always positive, it's not always easy, it's not always pleasant. That some of our coming together and practicing together and getting real with each other is sometimes really confronting. And I truly believe, and I know for myself, I needed to learn, and I still need to learn, and practice, like, healthy conflict. Not using our spiritual practice as, like, conflict avoidance, but acknowledging that there's going to be times where we have some conflict and some confrontations and having to hold people accountable or be held accountable. I recently... against the stream, we recently brought in a outside facilitator to facilitate our board of directors and the teachers council, and to look at our organization and say, like, okay, here we are 10 years in, and surviving, but not really reaching some of the goals. Like, years ago I said, I want us to have a residential retreat center by 2017. And then, they came in and they looked at us and they said, where's your retreat center? You set that intention 5 years ago. How come it didn't happen? How come you never did the fundraising to have your own center? Why didn't that happen? And so they were looking at us. And right away from the beginning, the facilitator said, you know what you guys are suffering from? Founder syndrome. And so it was like, and then everybody looked at me for my reaction. Yes. Saying like, oh yeah, Noah fucked this whole place up. And being able to be in that, and it was all true. And everything they were saying was like, and this is what founder syndrome means. Everybody's looking at me going, yeah. You totally did that. You got it started, and then, A, B, and C happen. And part of Sangha, for me, is being able to be confronted in that way and to show up and say, okay, let me look at this. What resonates is true. Where do I feel defensive? Where do I feel... and watching some of the other people in the room wanting to defend me, mm-hmm. and just trying to step back and be like, it's not that personal. Like, yes, this is just what happens when a personality starts a organization and then pretends like they know how to run a business. That, like, I don't, I'm a meditation teacher. I don't really know how to run a nonprofit, and founder syndrome, kind of just took over. I've got a lot of ideas. I don't write job descriptions. And I really feel, and I felt, actually I felt really loved by the board of directors and the other teachers, where they were able to say, like, yes, you've done some wonderful things, and you've made some mistakes, and your personality has gotten us so far, and actually it's time for you to get out of the way. And for me to be like, you are absolutely right. It's time for me to get out. We actually need an executive director. We actually need somebody that knows how to run a nonprofit that's, you know, at this level with meditation centers and a sort of national presence at this point. I don't know how to do that. I know how to teach Buddhism. That's what I'm good at. I need to stick at what I'm good at, not running a big nonprofit. And I actually felt really like that was, I felt like such a refuge in Sangha to be able to be, you know, a little bit confronted, but just like told the truth and be real with. And it helped me see some places where, oh yeah, there's these shadows, blind spots. You know the thing about blind spots? Can't see them. And what a wonderful function of wise friends. When we're willing to see ourselves through their eyes, when we're willing to have the humility to say, yeah, maybe you're probably right. Maybe you're right. Like, you're like, I trust you. You're paying attention. You don't have an agenda other than for the welfare of the community, for all of us. What a blessing to have people that will tell us the truth, even if it's unpleasant, even if it's ego bruising or something like that. Like, great. Like, that's what we're signing up for in the Dharma. Like, bruise my ego. My ego has caused me enough suffering in this life. It needs to be, have the light shined on it at times from other people. It's so hard to see it ourselves sometimes. So part of refuge and community, I think, is that level of intimacy that we can develop in long-term practice relationships with other people who we know are really doing their best to come from compassion and come from wisdom and to really pull us up and hold us accountable. I really appreciate that. And I know that I play that role in a lot of people's lives, and I really appreciate it when people play that role in my life. I had a student come to me a few months ago and say, you know, tell me these plans that he had to move across the country and some internship gig that he had. And I knew his story and I knew his, and I said, you have children and you're divorced and you're going to move across the country from your children for some opportunity. And I knew that actually his core wound was being abandoned by his father when he was a kid. I said, do you see what you're doing? And he did not like it. But we had a long-term, he'd been studying with me for a long time, and he was like, wow, brutal. And then, like actually had to go, but then came back around and said, thanks for telling me the truth, because everyone else was not telling me, was not confronting me in that way. And eventually he said, I'm not going to go. I'm going to stay with my kids. I said, don't fucking do that to your kids. That's what your dad did. Don't do it. And, even when I was saying, I was like, this is not a meditation teacher's role to, like, tell their students what not to do. But I just felt like with him, there was that level of connection and trust where I could say, this is how I see it. I think this is a terrible mistake. I think your children are more important than your career. And I think that you should not take that opportunity and that you should stay, even if it means something about your career. And so maybe that's not what Sangha means to everyone, but for me, I feel like I want that. I want that in my life. I want that for all of us, to have that level of accountability, that level of trust with other practitioners. And you only get it when you really commit to coming to group and keep coming to group and practicing with each other and making these relationships and sustaining them and really associating with people that we tell all of our truth to. And it feels pretty rare in this world to have that level of relationship. I don't know if it is. To me, it feels like. I never found it before when I was involved in practice. Maybe I wasn't looking for it. So I'm going to keep going on the threes, the significance of three, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. The Eightfold Path is broken down into three aspects. Sila, Samadhi, Panya, ethics, and meditation that lead to wisdom. Ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And so I feel like that's all where the whole path is about, am I being ethical with my speech? And ethics is all about karma. Am I creating positive karma or negative karma in my behavior, in the way that I'm speaking, in the way that I'm acting, in the way that I'm relating to money, earning money, relating to money? So it's speech, action, livelihood, the ethical aspect. And meditation broken down into mindfulness. Mindfulness and concentration. And knowing the difference. And knowing that they're both important. But that mindfulness is more important. Concentration is very important. But concentration has to be joined with mindfulness in order to transform our relationship to the three characteristics, to see the impermanent, impersonal, and unsatisfactory nature of things, just to really know the liberating insights of impermanence, to really know that the self that appears to be so solid, so continuous, so real, is actually not so solid, so continuous, or so real. And to understand that every conditioned phenomena, every pleasure, every pain, every material, sensual experience, in and of itself is not going to satisfy us. That the satisfaction that we seek, the happiness, the well-being that we seek, is not going to be found outside of ourself in experience. But it's going to be found through training the mind and heart, in accepting life, responding wisely to life, to understanding that whatever's happening is in a process of change, and responding wisely. I would break down most of the time, there's three responses that are being called for. If our experience is unpleasant, it's calling for compassion. And compassion is a bit of an umbrella term, I think, because it includes tolerance, it includes empathy, it includes mercy, it includes friendliness. And then ultimately, we just use the term compassion, which means meeting pain, something unpleasant, with care. Caring about something unpleasant that's happening, internally or externally. The term karuna, which we translate as compassion, which literally points to a way that our heart is moved. It's a vibration or a movement of the heart in response to pain. And so this response, life is calling for compassion so often. And there's the big ones, right? There's the big pains that are calling for compassion. But then there's just the everyday, ordinary, unpleasant. How many unpleasant experiences did you have today? If you're really cataloging your experience today, did you have some unpleasant sounds reach your eardrum? Did you have some unpleasant thoughts pass through your mind? Some unpleasant sensations, any discomfort today any emotional kind of. How, I mean, we must have hundreds, maybe thousands of unpleasant, maybe tens of thousands of unpleasant phenomena pass through us each day. Just the little ones, just the like the annoying train. You find the train pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, right? And if you're paying attention and you can really say, oh, it's pretty neutral, but some of us are like, well, it's unpleasant, it's distracting, or sitting in traffic, or being at work today. Was it pleasant all day? All of those little unpleasant experiences that we have are calling for some level of compassion. If we don't meet them with compassion, we almost instantly meet them with aversion. This is where the Buddha talks about compassion being a radical, a rebellion, a revolutionary act that goes against the norm. It's normal to hate pain. It's normal to have aversion to all of the little, unpleasant, average, ordinary experiences that we're being bombarded with thousands of times a day. And every single time we meet it with aversion, we create stress. We create dukkha, suffering for ourselves. And it happens all by itself. And that compassion is a choice. Compassion is a skill. Compassion is something that we actually have to train our hearts and minds to respond with. To say, like, it's unpleasant, and I care about what it feels like to be having this unpleasant experience. Takes some time. So I think we begin by learning to just tolerate it. Meditation is so good. Did you get uncomfortable during meditation tonight? When you get uncomfortable during meditation, being like, oh, this is awesome. This is an opportunity to learn to tolerate discomfort. To get like the skill of tolerance and kindness and compassion towards discomfort. I'm intentionally making my body uncomfortable so that I can get good at that, so that I can have this skillful response of compassion. If you can reframe all of the pleasant, unpleasant experiences of your life as an opportunity rather than a curse, rather than this sucks, of like, this is actually practice. This is what we're practicing for. So responding with compassion, or if it's pleasant, responding with, responding without clinging. And again, I mean, and those of you who practice with me, I know I say it every time, but I say it every time because I think it's the most important, it's what we are doing. It's what the Buddha's teachings are pointing us to. The core is non-attachment and compassion. Non-attachment and compassion. Not breaking that habitual reactive tendency of clinging to pleasant experiences and pushing unpleasant experiences away. And I like to add, not just non-attachment, but non-attached appreciation, because there's nothing wrong with appreciating pleasure and enjoying it. And we have to learn to have that relationship. We're like, this is incredibly pleasant, and I enjoy it, and it's okay, but it's impermanent. So I better not cling to this incredibly pleasant, impermanent experience, because then I'm going to create suffering out of this pleasure. It's like a magic trick. Watch me turn this pleasure into sorrow. Watch this. I can totally ruin this experience right now. Effortlessly. I make it look easy. But non-attached appreciation actually takes some effort, takes some training, takes some... It's a skill that we develop through our meditative understanding that it's all impermanent, understanding that it's not the source of our satisfaction, but that we can enjoy without taking hostage pleasant experience. The third, I don't know if the third is as much of, I tend to feel like, I was having a conversation with a monk that I really respect recently. And I said, I teach like this, that we are intentionally responding. He said, maybe. He said, I think actually the heart just reveals. He said that the more insight that you have through the vipassana, through the mindfulness, he said, I actually think that that non-attachment is not a choice that we make. It's just a natural wisdom that comes. And he said, it's like the heart is like a candle, and the mindfulness, but the candle, like the flame, the illumination of the candle is blocked by a curtain. He said, I think mindfulness just opens the curtain. And the more you're mindful, and then that heart, what he's talking about is this radiant heart. He said, and it just radiates non-attached appreciation. And it just radiates compassion towards pain. And it just radiates equanimity and loving kindness. That it's actually what the heart wants to do. That's what he said. He said, you're not really choosing at that level. And I think he's right, actually. But I had to fake it for so long before my heart naturally had any compassion. I had to just pretend for over a decade of like, okay, I'm going to meet this pain with, I care about you. I don't really, but I'm going to pretend to care about my pain. I'm going to train to respond with compassion. And that was part of this uncovering, this revealing of the awakened heart, which just cares. Of the awakened heart, which just appreciates without clinging. And because that third liberating experience is when we stop taking it all so personally. When we really step back through the meditative awareness, through the association and the dharma, and start to see, like, this isn't my fault. This isn't so personal. This is just the human condition. This is just what it's like. We've all taken incarnation into this mind-body process that creates suffering for us. We're all experiencing it together, this human condition. This mind that clings and craves, this body that has aversion to pain, this consciousness, memory, perception, and feeling that creates I am. And usually it's like, I am permanent. And this shit's never going to change. And I am this neurotic personality. And I am this aging body. And I am this wandering mind. But then you start to see it. You turn your attention towards it and say, it's not who I am. It's just what the mind does. It's not self. It's not so personal. And even starting to, and you'll see the way that I give instructions, and if you can start using kind of passive language or impersonal language, rather than saying my mind all of the time, start saying the mind in your own head, the body. And there's a shift that happens from I, me, and mine to this is just what it's like. And then when somebody tells you that you have founder syndrome, you won't take it so personal. You're like, yeah, probably. That makes sense. That would make sense to me. Not so personal. Now, maybe the line with that is not to get too weird and like, don't start talking about yourself in the third person. That line between not taking it all so personal, but also taking personal responsibility for our behavior. And that's where the sila, the ethics, the karma. We are responsible for how we respond to this impersonal process that's unfolding. We are responsible for what we say, what we do. We have karma. There's five I'm giving you a lot of lists tonight. There's the five daily reflections, where we reflect that I am of the nature to subject to sickness, subject to aging, subject to death. And even just those three, like it's so, to break the denial that we have around youth, the denial we have around continued existence, to bring some preciousness to life, this body that is hopefully healthy in the present moment is subject to sickness. Maybe it's not healthy. Subject to aging, this aging process. You're all aware of that, right? Gravity always wins. Subject to death. And that the fourth reflection is I'll be separated from everything that I cling to. Everything that I hold near and dear, I will be separated from. And that my only true possession in this life are my actions. The only thing I actually own, the only thing I get to keep in this life is my karma. That's it. I don't get to keep anything else. And anything else that I cling to will be a source of suffering. Total personal responsibility. Karmic momentum that we create based on our actions and our speech and our relationship to money, our relationship to sexuality, all of our relational activities, how we treat ourselves, how we treat others, is the only thing we actually own, the only thing we get to keep at death. That's it. That's the only thing we take with us. It's our karma. We take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha as a reminder that actually it's possible to be more and more awake in this lifetime. It's possible to know the truth more and more deeply for ourselves in this lifetime. And the community to support us and to confront us and to be accountable to. Many of you have been coming. I've been teaching this class for 12 years. I've been teaching Monday nights in Santa Monica for about 12 years. And you've all heard, those of you that have been coming for, you've heard all of this over and over. And you don't come for new information, right? Because you got all the information like 10 years ago. You read one Dharma book and you got all the information. Some of you are new and it's like, oh yeah, this shit's doesn't make sense at all. What the fuck's he talking about? Or, you're new, you hear the Dharma in the beginning, you're like, yes! And then you've heard it for years, and you're like, yep, heard that. But it's not about getting entertained or getting a new information. It's about the association with each other. We come and we remind each other, and we connect, and we practice together. And we take refuge in the potential for our awakening and the knowing the truth and practicing together. And again, it comes from ethics. We own our actions. And it comes from meditation. We develop these liberating insights through our meditative discipline. All of the wisdom that we seek will be revealed through our own actions, our own practice. So these are some of my thoughts that I share with you tonight. And any questions or comments, clarifications about anything that I shared, please in the back.
Not going to balance the understanding that clinging causes me suffering, but love causes me the opposite of suffering. And there's a woman that I love very much that I'm working hard to build this great relationship with, but that seems a whole lot like clinging. Also, she's impermanent and so am I, and that's a mess.
But when you're really in a moment of love, if you reflect on it, all of us, when there's that moment of really, I am in love, I'm loving, it's Doesn't it feel much more like an act of giving than of clinging? Like, when I feel like some pure love moments, it really feels like a flowing out like that has been, you know, like the heart is just like shining and it's not wanting any, you know, it's just wanting to give love. And then there can be the kind of flip side of it, which is, and I fucking don't want to receive it too. You better act right. But that's not, that clinging, that's not love. That's clinging. And they often come together, right? Because it's so pleasant and it's so intimate and it's so vulnerable that often we then cling around the love. But the perspective here is that the potential is non-attached, unconditional love. As a potential, even in intimate, sexual, loving relationships. That's what we're going for. And that it's connected. Connection is not clinging. And so you want to think about connected, non-attached, loving presence in a relationship. That's the ideal. And you know the difference. I know the difference from when I'm connected and when I'm clinging. Right? Can you see my hand puppets? Clinging, connected. And that there's an in connection and in intimacy, there's like a you're feeling connected. But you're also understanding, as you said, they're impermanent. They're subject to change. They have moods and sensations, and they have a mind that's experiencing pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. They're having desire for pleasure, aversion to pain, right? There, the more you know yourself, the more you know your partner. Because, you know, this is the human experience. And then also maybe there's some gender stuff that sometimes we have to figure out too. Of like, yes, we both have a human nervous system, but our conditioning may be similar or different, or so there's some of that communication styles that we need to learn. But ideally, you know, this is also why the Buddha is celibate. Because it's so fucking hard. Maybe celibacy might be easier. It sounds like celibacy would be more difficult, right? Like, never have sex again? No intimate, loving, sexual relationships? That sounds like a serious renunciation, right? None of us, as far as I can tell, are choosing that. We're all householders. We're all lay people. But maybe celibacy is easier because to be in that kind of loving, so pleasant, intimate, impermanent relationship without clinging, without creating suffering around it, is a very high path. My sense is, because I'm with you, I'm trying to do this too. I'm not currently in love, but I've been in love many times today. Over the years, and I'm with you as somebody who, and I spent a couple of years celibate, and I think that I really wanted to see what was this celibacy business about. Why is the Buddha celibate? How do we change our relationship to the suffering that we often create around sexuality and relationships? And so I've been doing this, I want to be in a connected, loving, non-attached relationship. And not only with, you know, I also, I'm doing this with, trying to do this with my children, with my friends, with, not just in the intimate sexual relationships, loving, but in all of the connections. How do I show up in a loving way that is present without being controlling, without being manipulated, that's willing to have some conflict, that's willing to have some humility, to be wrong sometimes. And it's a dance. where I come to is it's a dance, and that also it's a dance where sometimes there's that non-attached connection, sometimes there's clinging. My experience is that I'll often overcompensate, and rather than going from clinging back to non-attachment, I'll go to detachment. And then they'll have to kind of slowly come in. I'll kind of like take my marbles and go, I don't want to play with you anymore. And then I'll come back, reconnect, reclaim, disconnect, reconnect, reclaim. And that's just the process. But the more mindfulness, the more awareness, we say, oh, I'm clinging again, and I'm suffering. And I really actually want to just be connected, non-attached, loving presence. I'm not very good at it. It's really quite challenging to do. But we try, and we keep trying to do that. And those five reflections, you can not only do it for yourself, you can do it for your loved one. You say, you know, look into your beloved's eyes and say, you are of the subject, you're subject to sickness, you're subject to aging, you're subject to death. You will be separated from everything you love, and your only true possession is your karma. You don't want to say it out loud to them, but but we can bring that wisdom perspective that we're bringing to ourselves to each other, and to really cherish our time together in this impermanent process that we're in, and where even happily ever after ends in one of us dying first. One of us grieving the other one's loss. Just the way it is. It's not, you know, like we can be in denial about it, or we can just be awake. Like, this is the way it is here. And we can have so much joy and so much freedom and so much contentment when we look at it as the reality that it is, rather than denying it and pretending like impermanence isn't happening. Change isn't happening. It actually becomes a source of aliveness rather than a, I'm going to avoid that because it's going to hurt. It's like, yeah, it's going to fucking totally hurt. Let's go for it. And if you can go into a relationship like that, like, this is going to be brutal. Eventually. So that when it be, you know, when that happens, you're like, yep, now's the time. It changed. It ended. It, you know, it changed. And expecting that rather than being so caught off guard. You mean it's not going to be the honeymoon forever? You mean you have bad moods? This is bullshit. Does that make sense to you? Does it help? A little bit.
I know how to have compassion for other people, and even people that I'm angry with, or even downright loathe. But myself, when you talk about the self-compassion, if I break something that I didn't mean to break, and it really, like, I broke a window at the house, and it really bummed me out most of the day. Jackass I was, I should have known better. Or saying a joke to someone and them taking it completely wrong, and then I'm beating myself up because I don't want to present myself in that way. How do you have that self-compassion? I know in the 12-step program where I'm from, they say, well, drop the rock, give yourself a break, and all of that. But actually being able to put that self-compassion into practice, how do you do that?
Are you doing the meditation some?
I am.
Yeah. And it's not happening so much yet. So when you say to yourself, oh, you jackass, or, you know, whatever, you judge yourself. Is there anywhere where then you say, but it's okay? Where is there compassion a few layers out yet? I mean, that was my experience, was that it wasn't like, and all of a sudden, I no longer judged myself. But I would be like, oh, and I care about my, you know, somewhere out there, there's like, there, you know, do something unskillful, judge myself for it, judge myself or judging myself for it. I'm a bad Buddhist. I'm, you know, I'm not dropping the rock. I'm holding on to it. Whatever, you know, five layers of judgment. And then, you know, at some point the voice came in that was like, it's okay. You're trying. And, you know, there's some compassion that, and then it started to be at the fourth layer and the third layer. And, you know, the mind is still, I think that the mind is still going to judge us sometimes. But that's part of the impersonal. Like, part of it's compassion, but part of it is when your mind says jackass, you're able to be like, wow, look what my mind just said to me. I did something unskillful and my mind judged me, and you're not taking it as personally, and you're caring about that part of the mind, that there's compassion for it, but that maybe compassion doesn't get rid of. Sharon Salzberg in her book, Loving Kindness, talked about doing months of metta practice. And I think she had done a 3-month retreat or something like this, where she was just doing loving kindness. And she came out of the retreat and she broke something in the bathroom and her mind said, klutz. And then her mind said, but I love you. And that was her experience of the development eventually. It wasn't that the mind didn't judge, but that there was a part of her that she'd trained to meet even that judging mind with some kindness. And I think that's the process that you're in, and that it will happen more and more as you continue to practice the compassion. May I learn to care about myself, the loving kindness, the forgiveness. Jackass, but I forgive you. And I forgive my mind for insulting me. And I know that that's just a habitual survival instinct of the mind. Did something unskillful, felt unpleasant, embarrassed, and judged myself. Just what the ego mind does, not your fault. Okay, probably enough for tonight. As always, I share my reflections and the teachings with you in an open way for you to reflect on and for you to find out for yourself what resonates and what makes sense, and to really use the meditative practice to uncover what is true in your own direct experience rather than what anybody else says. But to really go deep in looking at your own heart and mind and relationship to pleasure and pain and self, and directly experience what's possible to directly experience in this life.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.